Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's Managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
I'm ready again.
Welcome to Knife Talk, podcast for knife makers, knife enthusiasts, DIYers, everybody who wants to know about knife making, the process, the business of, the ins and outs, the highs, the lows. We're with you. We got you. My name is Jeff Fader of Fader Knives, here with the great Mareko Momasi, Momasi Fire Arts, and Craig is in the midst. He's got something going on. We're going to see him next week. We're sending him our best regards and peace and love for an easy resolve. And we got us. Mareko, he got us. You and me. How the hell are you?
I'm doing all right. Actually, before I get into the last week, I got to, right off the jump, I'm going to be down in New Orleans.
You're kidding.
I'm going to be down in New Orleans right before the Super Bowl. Which is probably going to be a fucking batshit crazy, like fucking madhouse down there. But I'm going to be teaching a class down in New Orleans. What is it? Friday, Saturday, just before the Super Bowl. So February 7th and 8th. I'll be teaching a class at the Shapapila, at Shapapila Crafts, which is in Robert, Louisiana. It's about an hour north of New Orleans. Huh. So I'll be teaching a class there, and then I'll be hanging out with my sister. My sister lives in New Orleans. She's lived in New Orleans for like the last 15, 16 years, most of her adult life.
Question. So,
yes, go
ahead.
Is
there availability to be in the class?
Yes, that is a good question. That's the best question.
And how would we go about getting, reserving space in your class in New Orleans?
So as of the moment, I think I got six people signed up for the class. And so I basically have about six at the most spots available left in the class. And if somebody is interested, first off, I should also say that it is the Decoding Mosaic Damascus class. So you've heard me talk about this before, where I help you to understand pattern welding design and how patterns are created in steel, whether it's conventional patterns or mosaic patterns. That way, as a maker, if you're a maker, you can better plan those patterns and also understand what people are doing out in the world so that you can maybe reverse engineer them some and adapt some of those techniques to your own pattern making. But this is also actually a great class for people who don't know a fucking thing about how to make Damascus. Particularly actually collectors. And I'm kind of playing with the idea of teaching it or trying to figure out how to like focus it for collectors. Cause I think there are a lot of people out there making good Damascus, but I think some people kind of upsell their patterns when it's like, it's a fucking ladder pattern. Like, great. Ladder pattern is great. It has its place, but I think, anyways, the goal is to help with collectors or brand new makers, is that you can up their education so they understand what they're looking at, so they can make a more informed decision on how they're spending their money and where they're spending their money and who they're spending their money with. So anyways, Decoding Mosaic Damascus, two-day class, February 7th and 8th at Chappapila Crafts in Robert, Louisiana, just an hour north of New Orleans.
And they get slot. How do they get?
Oh, right. So if you're interested in registering for a class, I just realized I haven't even addressed that part.
Send
me an email.
It was a long way. Go ahead. Send you an email.
Send me an email, malmasifirearts at gmail.com, which you can find on my Instagram page if you follow me already. Just go to contact and you can send me an email straight from there. Say you're interested in the Louisiana class and I can get you the rest of the information about the class and what it's going to cover and all that stuff, and we can go from there.
So it's a two-day class.
It's a two-day class. It's okay. A seminar class. I've been teaching these seminar classes. They're not a traditional kind of make-and-take class. What you're taking away or walking away with is hopefully Damascus pattern welding design enlightenment. So that you can basically look at any pattern in the world and understand how it was made. As well as, especially for makers, figuring out how to better plan, more accurately plan the patterns that you want to make.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're in the mood, here's the move. Get your fucking Super Bowl tickets. Spend Friday and Saturday with Mareko, and then get all the coke and hookers you can handle at the Super Bowl. That's a fucking party right there, ladies and gentlemen. That is a fucking party in New Orleans? Jesus.
Yeah.
That's for me, and I'll take three.
Okay, so outside of that, I meant to actually talk about that last week, and we didn't do an after show, and I was like, oh, I'll save it for the after show, and then that didn't happen, and I was like, oh, fuck, I should have started at the top.
Well, it's fine.
Anyways.
We got you.
Bad brain. Anyways, so otherwise, the week, actually this last week, has been mildly unproductive for me. I'm going to try to be totally honest right now. I've been struggling with some depression, anxiety stuff, trying to work through it. And it's just like it's really had me on my ass in a way that has had me doing nothing in the shop. So, but I'm working through it, figuring it out. I got somebody I'm talking to. I know
Good.
You and I have talked about that before.
Good.
And I know it's, if anybody's hesitant about that, it's totally understandable. But holy shit, externalizing that shit and trying to talk it through with somebody who's kind of just like an objective party, helping to be an outside point of view in your thinking process around your life and yourself and whatever else you got going on is pretty fucking helpful. And so, like I said, I got somebody I'm talking to. I'm trying to be more open, honestly, even just with my own wife, because I think it's easy to feel like embarrassment or shame around it. So sorry, calm down a little bit. So it's feeling
okay.
Any kind of embarrassment or shame around it. No. But you know, I think you got to put a little bit of trust in the people around you that they care about you and they want to help you work through it. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't listen. This is very normal.
Yeah.
This is very normal to feel these ways. It's very normal to see someone. I saw a shrink for a long, long time, and there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. You're on the West Coast, where they make it seem like it's not normal to have a shrink. Over on the East Coast, everybody got a shrink. It's normal shit.
I actually started on the East Coast.
Yeah, dude,
head shrinker.
You got nothing to explain to anybody. You got nothing to feel bad about. You're trying to take care of yourself, and that's it.
Yep.
Jesus. I mean, you know, you're being honest. You're trying to help yourself, which is the best part. And you know, look, you're very vulnerable. So, you know, I salute you for being as honest as you are.
I know it makes you uncomfortable, but it
doesn't make me uncomfortable. Go ahead. I don't make you uncomfortable. It's fine by me.
No. I appreciate it. Yeah. So. I'm working through it.
You know what? You know, it's not easy. None of this shit's easy. Life isn't easy, you know, and you got to figure out ways in which to get better. That's all.
Yeah.
But I salute you. I mean, we talked about this in the last podcast. I mean, you're very open and honest about your struggles, and the fact that you're so forthcoming is very helpful to other people. So if it makes you feel any better, I mean, you're making other people realize that they can get help too. So
yeah.
God bless.
Thank you.
I'm with you, dude. And that's not the bullshit I'm with you. That's the fucking real
I'm with you. It's not the bullshit I'm with you. It's not the bullshit I'm with you. I'm with you.
That's not the bullshit I'm with you. That's the real I am with you. I am with you. And you know, you got my number. Anytime you need somebody, you always got me. So
I appreciate it.
I appreciate your honesty. So I appreciate you. You know, you're a good guy. I've known you. The funny thing is when people ask me about my relationship with you, because we've known each other a little bit before the podcast, and then we've been talking like once a week for fucking 7 years on a podcast for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And when I refer to my friendship with you, I often refer to you as my younger brother. And I feel like we have this. I see you as kind of like a younger brother to me, and that is like that's a high compliment coming from me, because it's like, well, I mean, not that you need a high compliment, but like I always usually refer to you as, you know, he's like my younger brother, and you know, I feel very loyal, and you know, I think about you often in a very fine, in a very positive way. Just to let you know.
I appreciate it.
All right.
No, I really do. It means
a
lot.
No, it's true. It's true.
I will say, when I am struggling with being productive and staying on task on what I'm supposed to be doing in the shop, I'm very good at distracting myself. And I actually designed a couple folding knives.
Oh, that's good.
So there's that.
Anything. You know, guys know me. I'm Mr. Toil. Anytime you got to just put your fucking head down, no matter what it is, you got to just keep busy, you know? And sometimes it's just not. Sometimes the hardest part about the knife making game is everybody is so solitary. That's probably one of the reasons why Knife Talk is as popular as it is because people are solitary and they're listening to a podcast where we're speaking their language. And because when you first start out as a hobby, you don't have other people doing it with you. Sure. So it is solitary, and it is hard to just kind of like understand how to be, you know, efficient, and when the money comes in, it makes it harder because all of a sudden you feel the pressure of your own success, and I think it's tough. So look, you're speaking to a lot of people are feeling a lot of the same ways.
Yeah.
And my move is always is just fucking have a game plan and just stick to the fucking game plan, even if it's gonna suck.
So go ahead.
No, that's it. I mean, this week sucked.
Yeah. I was just going to say, while you're talking about how it's a solitary situation, I was thinking about all the, like, there are a few shops where people share space. I've shared space with the Dragon Forge guys, but I was thinking about Brigham Kandel, where he's got a fucking person making phone calls in the next cubicle over while he's hand sanding and making his knives.
Deep cut, apparently.
He's never solitary. He's always got somebody there, either on the phone or pounding on the wall.
This is a deep cut. If you listen to the last episodes, Brigham Kandel, one of our guys, Bingo. Bingo is a Gold Star listener. Like he joins the ranks of Paul Jansen as a Gold Star listener. 100%. Motherfucker learned how to make knives and figured out a way to make knives at his job. And he got a desk and he's making his knives at the goddamn desk, taking phone calls, and his boss walks by, and then not only is he paying him, but he buys his knives. Guy, you're talking about like having his cake and eating it too.
December 10th, we talked about that. December 10th episode.
You can't make it up. I mean, a guy's smarter than I think he might be the smartest guy in the knife game.
I think so too.
Jesus Christ. But I tell you what, talking about lousy weeks.
Let's hear it.
I tell you what was the worst. The worst, well, not the worst. Look. Nothing's really truly the worst, but before the new year, I wanted to spend some money before the tax man got to see what we made.
Oh yeah,
and I bought a whole big tank of oil, and I had the heat going this whole year, and the boiler was working, the furnace was working, keeping the shop warm. And then a couple days before New Year's, I thought, you know what I need to do is I need to focus on re-insulating the shop a little bit, because a number of years ago our sprinklers froze and that was a disaster. So I got all sorts of insulation for all the pipes in that shop. I was on a ladder all, you know, for half the week putting insulation up on the pipes, and then I found these great insulation panels that I can put against the roll doors so I can move them.
Nice.
And everything is good. About the full tank of gas, or took full tank of oil, and I turn it on Tuesday, which was the coldest fucking day of the year. Furnace wouldn't go. I called the company to fix it, and because we don't have a service plan with them, we're on the last, and it was the coldest day of the year, so everyone's calling to get their furnace fixed.
Right.
So he was supposed to be there at 10 in the morning. He didn't show up till 5 at night, and the shop was freezing. I ran around trying to get electric heaters, and then he came, and the guy was a bit of a douchebag, but he's my douchebag. And then the next morning, he fixed it, and then the next morning, turn it on, no heat. So then we had to get it to come again, and it was frustrating because I've been in so many shops where we've never had heat for the workers, and it's just like, you know, the boss will say, oh, you know, you got the heat's in the tools, and you guys don't realize what we had to deal with, and money doesn't grow on trees, and you know what, I dealt with it. I dealt with a lot of shops where, you know, you can see your breath, and I decided the past couple of years ago we're not doing that anymore. So I've been really like focused on trying to make sure this is a comfortable place to work. So we got the heater going. We got it blasting. It's a nice and balmy. We got a couple electric heaters. It looks like a rotisserie chicken roaster, and you know, we're cranking away. But all problems aside, and you know, I was thinking about the All Beef Review last week. Got a lot of nice messages about the All Beef Review.
Oh, nice.
It's meant to be kind of funny. It's not really meant to be, you know, real gripes. I mean, obviously, you know, we're talking about people driving. It's not really the end of the world. Sure. This week was also tough because my daughter, thank God, I have to say this only because I get so many messages. My daughter goes to school in Los Angeles, and the fires in Los Angeles are terrible. They're terrible. They're terrible, these wildfires, to the point where my daughter's home for winter break. We got a message saying the rest of the student body who is staying there, a lot of athletes, got evacuated. It's in the path of one of the wildfires. Mm-hmm. And then the school is closed. So we're hoping she's not supposed to go back for another week, but we're hoping that things get resolved. But we're glad that she's here. And a lot of messages wondering if she was okay. In the meantime, our buddy Nick over at Fell Knives. You know Nick?
Yeah.
Nick's fucking awesome, but his house burned down in Altadena. I chatted with him a little bit. I texted with him a little bit. He and his family are okay. They're with his fiance's family, but I spent some time. I know Nick for a long time. Yeah. Fell Knives, guy's an awesome guy. Just, he's really self-made, just a total guy. Lost everything. In his house. So he lost the house or wherever he's staying, and he's going to figure things out. I kind of text with him. I said, you know, when there's something that you need from us, we'll help promote whatever you need to promote. So guys, it all could be worse. So put Fell Knives in your, you got their prayer box or whatever. What the hell do they do? At night, when you sit down and you talk to the Lord, send one to our man, Nick, and follow Fell Knives. And he's post some pictures on his stories that are pretty, the whole neighborhood's destroyed. So in the grand scheme of things, it could all be worse, you know?
Sure.
So with that said, welcome to Knife Talk, the most depressing knife-related podcast in this
depressing
planet. Holy crap! Craig would have already. I mean, who knows what would have happened? He would have probably said in the middle of that, "I have to take a shit," but you never know. Well, that part of the podcast we can talk about is sponsored by Evenheat, manufacturers the finest heat treat ovens available. To get your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. Don't play. I'm trying to get them this to be their new slug line. If you got to get it hard, use an even heat. But I mean, you never know.
Okay.
Well, is there anything else you want to talk about? You want to do some questions? Whatever you want to do, my man.
Nah,
I want to cheer you up too. You know, we got to cheer everybody up.
I had a good heart to heart with my wife. For people who aren't aware, I'm the wife. My wife helps with kind of the administrative side of stuff that I'm absolutely terrible about, keeping things organized and all that jazz. And so I'm feeling much better. And we had a really good talk for the last fucking like 3 hours, basically.
Wow.
Kind of hashing it out and working through some stuff.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Flurry
series of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
And yeah, so I'm good. So you don't have to worry about cheering me up too much, but I'm always down for a laugh.
We're going to we're going to just sprinkle in dick jokes every so often. Okay. We can't be like, I mean, you know, we can't expect our listeners to tell us jokes, that's for sure. And why don't you read the first question? It's not going to be funny at all.
Yeah, here we go. This one's from Performance Edgeworks. It says, "Hey cuties, my name is Jordan, and I have a question for you. Let's assume you're trying to target 62 Rockwell in your chef's knives. Does it make a difference if you use a higher austenitizing temperature and a higher temperature during temper cycles versus a low austenizing temperature and a lower temperature during the tempering cycles to reach your target Rockwell? Thank you, KTP, for all the time you dedicate to the best knife making related podcast in this germ infested planet."
And the most depressing.
And the
it's going to be the funniest in a minute. So
yeah, don't worry about that. You know, we have our ups and downs. We're going to knock you down.
That's right,
and lift you back up.
That's right. We're going to be like a fucking Richter scale. It's going to go up and down.
Tickle, right?
Slap and tickle.
Slap and tickle. All right. What
do
you think?
This is the easiest answer in the world. You go get yourself knife engineering by Dr. Laren Thomas.
Yep.
And if you don't have knife engineering by Dr. Laren Thomas, what's going on with you? It's got, not only does it explain knife making, but it has a recipe book in the back, but it'll show you ranges. And this is the best part. This is why there ain't nobody better than Dr. Laren Thomas. So he's a real deal doctor. He's not one of them bullshit, you know, knuckle crackers. You know what I'm saying? He's a real deal metallurgist. And he'll have in the back the different alloys. And that's the crazy part is this question is, it would be really easy if you could just say, yeah, if you have it high, you quench it up with austenizing temperature high, you're going to get a disc, you're going to... If you get the knife engineering in the back, it's going to have every alloy you're using. It's going to give you a range of where you need to be. So yeah. There will be, you know, like perfect example is Nitro V. I'm doing a little Nitro V. It says, you know, between 1900 degrees and 1950, depending on how long you quench, and then you're going to end up with a particular range. That's the best part about heat treating. It's a range. So what you want to do is get yourself involved with that, and you can get it at Maritime Knife Supply. Maritime Knife Supply has, I believe, Lawrence has knife engineering by Dr. Laren Thomas.
Right. Yep. Last I saw.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know. It would be easy for me to just say yes. The answer is yes. But the best thing is you have to start thinking about these as ranges, almost like a cake. You don't want the cake to be too moist or you want it to be too dry. This is what you do. Higher temperature, lower temperature. It's all ranges.
Yeah. So when it comes to Rockwell hardness, I think a lot of people get really caught up on that actual data point because, honestly, it's one of the few data points you have to work with in regards to talking to your customers or even just talking to other makers about where your knives are regarding the heat treat and somehow that translating to performance. But how you get to that number does really play a role. And while, like when I heat treat my knives, I'm heat treating from 1475, which is not a high temperature. I think especially for my Damascus mixture is usually 1080 and 1075, 1080 and 15 and 20. And so for those steels, I think the highest temperature you want to go to is at around 1500 or maybe 1550 at the most. One thing, and so depending on the steel you're heat treating from, or heat treating, you could potentially play with a particular range. So I potentially could heat treat my steel from as low as like 1425, but because I have integral bolsters, it is kind of tricky to get that massive steel cooled down fast enough so that it transforms to a Martin Siddick structure, and so when it etches, which is going to happen at the end of all the knife finishing, I'm etching my Damascus. If it didn't fully transform, it's going to actually appear slightly differently. It doesn't ultimately really affect the performance of the knife, but aesthetics wise, it will. So I could potentially be heat treating from between 1425 all the way up to 1525, 1550, maybe at the max, and still get great results. Once I start getting above that 1500 degree, 1550 degree temperature, that's when you start to potentially, or you're not potentially, you are going to start experiencing grain growth. In fact, once you get above critical, most steels, they're the critical temperature where the austenite range starts is around 1325 to 1375, depending on the steel and the alloying elements that are in it. Again, Dr. Larry Thomas's book has a lot of references to all those different things. Kind of talks about, I think, how those different elements affect the heat treating range and response and all that kind of stuff. But anyways, generally speaking, once you get above around 1350, 1375, your grain in your steel starts to grow. The larger those grain, those austenite grains grow, the more brittle you can say you can harden from 1600 degrees or even 1575 if for like a 1080 or something like that. I'll get a really high hardness, but my grain size will also be quite large, which makes my blade also a little bit more delicate or potentially not as tough as I would like it to be. And most of us are making knives that are either hard use, or even if you're using just a knife in the kitchen, if you're trying to even just like cut through some seeds, like it can fuck with the brittleness of that steel to the point, even if you heat treat it down because of those grain, the size of those grains, if you pull it down to 60 Rockwell, you potentially could be experiencing cracking or chips blowing out of the edge. And so I try to heat treat personally from as low of a viable temperature as possible. And I found that to be for myself about 1475. And then once I quench in the oil, it's a high enough temperature that everything transforms to austenite. It's enough time for me to get the steel out of the forge and into the oil and cool down fast enough so that everything transforms at the same rate, generally speaking. But enough so that the bolster, my integral bolster, isn't messing with the or isn't different hardness wise, I guess, in regards to the rest of the blade or in relationship to the rest of the blade. If I was doing non-integrals, 1475 honestly would still be a good temperature. You could potentially pull it down even further to like 1450. But be careful pushing, I guess this is all to say, be careful pushing your steel or your temperatures higher just to try to hit a target hardness, because while a high hardness sounds really cool, the path by which you get there is really important. It's actually probably more important than the actual hardness of the steel. That goes into like the thermal cycling, the grain refinement, or the normalizing. If you're going to do a subcritical anneal, all of those things play into that final data point. But how you get to that data point is really important. If you're just jamming it in the forge and quenching it and getting a high hardness and a file skating, great. But then the first time you fucking, if it's an outdoor knife, you chop into something, the fucking blade breaks, what's the fucking point of that high hardness? Of those results, those heat treating results.
This guy is just—he's aiming for a particular. Aiming for a particular hardness. Now, the only thing I would add is really like, you know, not the heat treatment spot. Let's just say you got the heat treatment squared away. It's the question of what you want your customers to have, and I think that, and no disrespect to outdoor guys, but a lot of times outdoor guys have an idea of what they're looking for. And I don't know Performance Edgeworks. I'm assuming, I'm making an assumption, and pardon me if I'm wrong. But when you have a culinary knife, you also want it to be maintainable. And I've actually bucked a lot of the systems of a lot of knife makers who do very thin to win. And these kind of like, you know, when they put their fingernail and then you can see the ripple of the knife. I find that to be very difficult for people to maintain. Now, I don't make very, very expensive. I mean, sometimes some of my knives are expensive. I don't make super duper expensive knives. And I want my knives to be able to be maintained, not only by the customer, but most likely who she's going to send it to. So my opinion is I always put a little bit extra material back, and I also try not to make sure it's not too hard. The harder the knife, the harder it is to maintain. And what happens, I had a knife maker come in this week, great guy. He's starting new business with a friend of mine, and we were kind of going over things. He's starting this new business. When it comes out, I'll talk about it. I have nothing to do with it except for I helped him. We were talking about, you know, sharpening and customer sharpening. And he was talking about it. He likes his knives, his particular knives, on the hard side. And I said, well, here's a problem. If your customer doesn't want to sharpen them or maintain them, like a lot of people do, sometimes my knives aren't like razor blades all the time. The longer it takes for them to sharpen it, the harder it is for them to bring it back. And the harder the knife is to bring back into the sharpness that you once got it at. So that's also part of the juggling act of, in regards to culinary knives, what is your end result? Do you want this to be something that your customer calls you up and say, this fucking thing is like a piece of glass I can't sharpen at all?
Yeah.
Or do you want it to be something that they can kind of like stick their foot in, stick their toe in and say, hey, you know what? Sharpening's easy. I can do this. I enjoyed doing this. Or they're going to send it to the lawnmower guy. Lawnmower guy's going to put it on the next thing you know, it's going to be a serrated knife.
The silicon carbide wheel.
I'm telling you. So I think that there's a lot more. I love this question because it's like there's a lot of ranges in regards to how you heat treat. And then we don't even talk about the fact that tempering changes your heat treatment. So like you can harden something, get it super hot, get it super hard. And then between 300 and 450, you're going to change the Rockwell. You're going to soften it up. Yep. But at the same time, I think that it's very important for people to kind of have a better idea. And look, experience, like we said, every week, experience is underrated. You're going to see what you like. Just because you hear other people talk about Rockwell and you talk about what they want, understand what the end user is probably not going to be used to something like, I once had a friend of mine, says he makes his knives 67 Rockwell. And I'm like, well, who the fuck's going to use that? I mean, well, what are you going to do with 67 Rockwell? Sure. Who's going to sharpen that motherfucker?
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to get? Tungsten?
Again, the question for me would be, how the fuck are they getting there? Because you can get a higher hardness with higher temperatures. But like I said, there's a fucking trade-off.
Right.
Larger grain structure makes the blade a lot more delicate, honestly. And knives are kind of generally hard-use tools. And if it's going to snap or the edge is going to crack or pop out a chip, like what's the fucking point of that high hardness?
Right.
Because the second that happens, a person's going to be like, yo, I just spent, even if they spent $350 on it,
fix it.
You're going to say, what the fuck is this bullshit that you sold me? I spent all this money on it, and now the edge is blown out chips. What the fuck?
Yeah, you got like a dime-sized chip in there, and then all of you tell them like, oh, I can fix it, but all of a sudden it's going to be, you know, half an inch thick, you know, more narrow. And he's like, that's not what I paid for.
Sure.
It's a great question because, once again, we're in this position where people are learning how to do it. And the funny thing is, I think when we first started this podcast, there were not as many people making culinary knives. And I think you, me, and Craig were also kind of like quiet about it because it was just like they don't realize that our listeners, they don't realize that when you make culinary knives, all of a sudden your demographic changes. It's men and women. It's all sorts of people need to cook their food. And then that showed up, and next thing you know, everyone with a Bowie knife are cutting off them guards, and they're making culinary knives. But the problem is you have to see what is easy. The crazy part is, another crazy part we talk about all the time, is that Henkel and Wusthof, they harden their knives to like 54 Rockwell.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because they know it's going to be easier for people to maintain, among other things.
Yeah, they're tailoring kind of to the lowest common denominator.
Right, yeah. And that's also the reason why people think that carbon's better than stainless. It's because these motherfuckers are making, like, you know, bullshit knives, you know, 54 Rockwell on AEBL or whatever, and all of a sudden it's just like, you know, of course it's going to not hold an edge. You crazy? Sure. All right, we've said enough.
Well, and I will just a couple last things.
Yeah, let's do it.
So I will say that some steels just have their limitations.
Right.
You can get 60 Rockwell with a steel, with a basic carbon steel, with as low of a carbon content as 50% or 0.5% by volume. So what we would call like 5%. And most knife makers are trying to play closer to around 70, 80, or around 1% carbon. God, that's confusing. Anyways.
I don't know, percentages and millimeters and thous, I'm all out. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about me.
I meant 0.7, 0.8, or 1% carbon. By content, but you can actually get 60 Rockwell. Look at 5160. 5160 is kind of a tried and true, tough as fuck steel, and it's only got 0.6% carbon in the composition. But the other alloying elements, like the chromium, while it's not a ton, it does play a role in how tough it is, how well it holds an edge, the wear resistance. Again, like what Jeff was saying, you know, you can get an ultra hard knife. That's great and all, but if it's got a bunch of, if it's got tungsten or vanadium or chromium even, that's really going to have a massive effect on what your customer, the actual person who's going to be using that knife, how they can take care of that knife. And that's really, honestly, a really important part of the conversation or equation to take in consideration. Because again, the Rockwell hardness, I feel like it's a fun data point for people to throw around and kind of like puff their chests up about. But it's like, how is that knife actually being used? And how does that affect the end user? And how effectively they can honestly take care of that thing over the life, over their lifetime, over the lifetime of that knife.
I had a good friend of mine who bought some knives, and he sends me messages. He says, "What's the Rockwell on these knives?" And I wrote to him, I'm like, "What the fuck do you know about it? I said, "What do you know about it?" I said, "If I give you a number, what do you know about it? Tell me what you know about it." And there was silence. He's just like, "I don't know. I just heard about Rockwell." I'm like, "Don't worry about it. You know, we're talking 58, 59, 60, or somewhere in there. Don't worry about that. That was a long time ago." I was just like, don't start belting off words to me. Come on, man. It's just me here. I know a guy, you know, we both know an awesome knife maker who's just like, you can make a culinary knife at 54 Rockwell. Nobody gives a shit. You know, it works great. I made them at 55 Rockwell, 54 Rockwell, and they work great. So, you know, I the experience is underrated. And that was a great question. And I would highly suggest to all listeners of this podcast, get Knife Engineering by Dr. Absolutely. Laren Thomas, because I wouldn't say it's a bedtime story for your kids, but in the back,
it's a good bedtime story for you though. The technical jargon might put you to sleep pretty quick.
I mean, let's face it. I mean, come on,
read it. But in the shop.
I mean, Jesus Christ. But at the same time, like today, I got some Nitro V because the particular material I was quoted on didn't arrive, and they said we can get it to you in Nitro V. And I was like, well, how does that heat treat to AEBL? And he said, super duper similar. There's hardly a difference. And then I double checked that with Dr. Laren Thomas's book. I mean, I changed all my recipes to interact with the ranges that he suggests.
Right.
And it's ranges. So yeah. I would highly suggest get him that. And then with that said, why don't we talk about our next question from Stu Lind. Stu Lind. What's each of your favorite belt and why? There are 7,152,000 different options out there. Just thought you might have some interesting thoughts. What are your favorite belts?
My favorite belts?
I have a favorite belt. I have an easy. That's. I mean, there's no question about it. I got two favorite belts.
Okay. I think, I don't know if I necessarily have a particular brand that I really love, but I will say that I've really fallen in love with the 120 grit.
Wow.
120 grit.
Jeez.
It's like on the verge of polishing, but still aggressive enough that you can do some material removal. But
it's the hometown honey. That's the hometown honey.
Hometown honey.
You got your. When you're
I really love the 36 because you can get. I can get a shit ton of work, ton of material removal, real quick before then advancing in grits. But I can get like 80%, 85% the way done with my grinding with the 36. And then what is it Nick Jay says? Anything after that's polishing. You ever heard him say that?
I haven't heard him, but I'm that sounds like something like I would say. The big guardian angel gargoyle. My fucking favorite monster. Go ahead.
Big man from Vermont. And then I'm trying to think. Actually, I feel like also 220 is another pretty sweet spot because now you're starting, I feel like, at least with steel, you're starting to get into the polishing zone. But when it comes to the handle sculpting, I can go straight from 36 to 220. 220 is shockingly aggressive, and I can get, even like I said, when with the handle sculptor, I can get a lot of the work done at 36, but then I can actually, I feel comfortable jumping straight from 36 to 220 and getting my shit done at the 220 because I try to jump grits wherever it makes sense, but sometimes, you know, it just doesn't make sense, and you got to go through the progression. But the 220 is for me, when it comes to handle sculpting, can get a lot of work done.
Do you have a company preference that you like?
I really like the J-Flex. I don't care if it's Hermes or any other kind of brand, a Kingsplore or whoever else, or Klingsplore or whatever the fuck it is. Yeah. The 220. I don't like the serrated edges.
You don't like the scalloped edges?
Fuck no. I tried scalloped edges once in 2015, and I was like, nope.
I like the scalloped edges. The times I used them, but I didn't love them enough to buy more.
Yeah.
So, but I loved them. Not that much.
I did not enjoy it.
I you know what? I liked it, but like I said, not enough to buy another one. So.
Well, to me, the scalloped edge is like the idea is that you can get into contours that are difficult to get into.
No gouging.
Yeah, with a solid edge. But you know what the trick is? Take some of the fucking tension off your belt. Or track the belt off the wheels just a little bit, and you can have a floppy edge out there getting into all kinds of contours, and that's what I do. And I don't fuck around with any scalloped edges, and I get great results.
I have a direct answer.
Let's hear it.
To Stu Lin's question. I love the yellow Norton Razor Stars. That you can get at Maritime Knife Supply. Oh, 36, nice. The 36 grit Norton Razor Stars are my favorite belt that I use by a mile. They're yellow. I love Norton. Hey, listen. A Norton Blaze, they're coming from the stainless steel angle, so it's a little bit harder than. I mean, you know, you ain't. I mean, that 120 hometown honey. I mean,
ain't
coming
shit
out
on
for a
stainless.
Long. It ain't coming out. I mean, I don't even buy 120s anymore because on stainless, it's like a fucking wreck. I mean, what's the point?
Yeah.
But a 36 Norton Razor Star, yellow or a orange Norton Blaze, fucking can't get better than that. I mean, I've tried them all. I've tried them all.
You have.
And I get the Norton Blazes or Norton Blaze are awesome. Norton Blaze are awesome. But the Norton Razor Star, it's the yellow belt from Maritime Knife Supply, is insane. I'm not saying they don't make it. He stocks them. He sent me some. Yep. And now he's like that drug dealer who says, hey kid, try this. It's good for you.
Let me just give you a taste.
Really? He's giving you a taste. Try this. See what you think. I'm like, oh, I need some more of those yellow Razor Stars. Lawrence, you have any more? Yeah, I have some more. Come over to Maritime Knife Supply, MaritimeKnifeSupply.com, and I'll get you all the yellow Norton Razor Stars you can want. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Lawrence. You got me. And what else you got, Lawrence? I have the Norton Blazes, too. I got whatever you need. If you want, listen, guys, whatever you need to get your addiction scored up and settled in, go to MaritimeKnifeSupply.com, and you can get a 10-pack of abrasive belts. You don't have to put any promo codes in. You know why? I'm going to tell you why. And I have a conversation. Somebody says to me, what's the promo code for Maritime Knife Supply? And Lawrence says, I can't get the prices lower. And if I started to give you a 10% off, I'd have to charge everybody more. So he's giving you the lowest prices he can, and he's selling them out. And guess what, ladies and germs? The Canadian Postal Service has settled all their situations and are all squared away. So back and forth, no problem. Send it to Canada, it's Canada back, we're all good. Everything's all squared away. So go to MaritimeKnifeSupply.com, get yourself some of them Razor Stars, baby. You won't regret it. I'm telling you. Especially if you're a stainless steel guy, oh, baby.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I would really love, I've never taken the time to buy like an individual of each brand, I guess.
not doing
it. I will say I used to get the Norton Blaze because everybody swore by them.
Oh.
But I'd get halfway through that fucking belt and it would glaze over. And I think the ceramic abrasive is too hard for what I was doing. And so at a certain point, it would cut like a fucking dream. And then at a certain point, it would just stop. Even though I could see and I could feel that there were still tons of abrasive on there, it was not cutting my blades. And I couldn't figure out what to do to open them up. And I started using, that's when I started using other belts. And I was getting, I felt like I was getting more action out of them and getting longer use and really using those belts down. But yeah, I don't know. I've heard also really great things about like Cubitron 3s and I don't know.
I don't fuck around too much with any of this stuff. I remember I was with Aaron Wilburn during class years ago, and he says to me, just use belts like they're free. You got to use them like they're free. And I can't do that because I have, you know, I have a mountain of belts. I have a mountain of belts that I've never thrown away.
A
lot of it's because...
Are they still going on the lathe?
Oh, dude, yeah. The lathe is, it's like a giant sculpture now. I have been storing Cliff Dufton's lathe for years.
What's the name of the sculptor? Sculpture.
It's the metamorphosis, I guess. I mean, I'm trying to turn it into a cocoon and then hopefully it'll like transform into a, you know, a little giant or something like that. You know, I don't
really
need
it. The lummox and the laborer.
Something. And, I don't throw old belts away, especially 36 grit, because the belts I use for stainless, they may be bad for new stainless, but they're not bad for other things. So I'll pack them up. I'll give them to John Ariani and Cliff Dufton. They use them for everything. I'll bring them a box every so often of just my used belts, which are better than their new belts. So I don't like to throw them away, but at the same time, of all of them, Norton Blaze for me is definitely a great belt, but the Norton Razor Stars 36 grits are awesome.
I see. So Lawrence is pedaling to you, and then you pedal on to John and Cliff.
I still have the used Norton Razor Stars. They're yellow belts, so I know where they are. So I got a pile of the old ones. I still use them for other things, like profiling.
Profiling, you know, for sure.
For any kind of profiling, we got a pile of forks come in, and I did all the profiling with one used, you know, belt. And I get very sketched out about throwing them out because I'm like, they're good for something. And like when I was making a hammer, I'm not using a new belt for hammer. I'm only using new belts for when I'm grinding stainless steel blades, and that's it. You know, everything else, clutch. I'm gonna try to like stretch out as far as I can because, you know, like you said, they glaze over, but you can kind of fix them. I'm not sure really. Everyone gets these fucking fakakta. If you know how to fix a glazed belt, if you're listening to this podcast, you're saying, I know how to fix a glazed belt, send it into Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram, and we'll read off your ideas on how to fix a glazed over belt. You know what I'm talking about. You use the belt, and all of a sudden it's kind of glassy and it's not cutting, and you lose all that. You tell us how to break up them, whatever, ceramic teeth.
I got some tips, but we'll save it. We'll save it because this will be a good conversation for next week.
This is real knife talk, ladies and gentlemen. This isn't some bullshit. I told you, it was depressing, and now it's great. And it was great before. It goes ups. It's got downs. We got laughs. We got cries. We got whatever you need. We got the whole fucking situation. And if that ain't good enough for you, go to Indasa USA and Texas Ferry Supply and wipe down them tears with some Rhino Wet. Get yourself some 220 Rhino Wet and rub your ass, whatever you want. Get some 220. I used to say on the podcast, I used to say the best, if you're out of toilet paper, get that Rhino Wet 800 grit. And you, 120,
800,
not wow. 800, the 250, the 2500.
Yeah,
get the 2500 and you're like, you know.
Silky smooth.
You got silky smooth. It's like a baby's butt after you're done with it. So go to TexasFarrierSupply.com for all your belts, abrasives, all them farrier stuff, all your tongs. Get yourself some gator piss over there, and you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, and you get your 10% off. And I would highly suggest getting the Rhino Wet. Get the 220 just even to try it. The 220s, I think, for hand sanding, the 220 is like the best. Because
heavy lifter.
I think it's the best. I think the 220 Rhino Wet is like... probably my favorite. That's the one I spend the most on. So definitely go get yourself some of that 220 Rhino.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Let's do another question.
We got that, and we also have listener feedback, whatever you want. Oh, this one looks good for you. You should definitely answer this one.
This is Devil's Hollow Forge.
Yes.
Hey, fellows. Hope life is good. Been trying to find a good video, but haven't found one I necessarily trust. I've always hot stamped my maker's mark and am switching to electro etch. My question is, do you do the maker's mark before the final acid bath on Damascus or after? I use gator piss for my finish etch and just didn't want to do the steps backwards and make more work for myself. Appreciate ya. Devil's Hollow Forge. Yeah, I mean, you've done some Damascus. What's your take?
I have, but I get, well, it's funny because I actually, when I use the Baker Forge stuff,
yeah,
the etching doesn't work very well on the copper. So the copper starts to fool around a little bit. So a lot of times, if I can, I'll hot stamp in something or cold stamp something in. But when it comes to Damascus, unless there's like a really good spot, I think my maker's mark looks dumb on when if it's too much black. So if I just don't, in my mind, I'm just like, it doesn't look good. So sometimes if but I'll tell you what, if I were to do it, what I would do is I would do your etch and then I would do the maker's mark and then I would do the coffee etch.
Oh, okay.
But because I mean the gator piss, I love gator piss. I am all about the gator piss. GATORPISS. Gator short for alligator, piss short for urine. I'm all.
That sounds like a cheer.
I've been doing that for fucking years.
You mentioned that at a basketball game.
I've been doing that shit
gator
for
piss,
years.
Gator piss, hell yes.
Yeah, I've been doing that. That has been my bit for a long time for Coy Baker.
Yeah.
And the thing about gator piss is it's very aggressive. So like I would use the gator piss to make my etch, but I wouldn't do it for the final changing of the color. I like the coffee etch is still my favorite because it's also not as aggressive. But I would love to know what you do because you do such a beautiful job and your touch mark is long as shit. It's almost like a paragraph. So I want to know how you do it so nice. Just kidding, clearly. Yeah.
So I do, I'd use the electro marker and I do all my hand sanding. And then I electro mark my blade. So I haven't touched it to acid at all yet.
Huh.
And then
deep.
Yeah, it's pretty deep. Like, yeah, yeah. It's probably 15 thousandths of an inch deep. I'm probably spending a couple minutes there. And it's tricky because you got to make sure you do a good job keeping like the mark clean and stuff like that. My good buddy Bill Grulick Knives, he gave me a good tip a long time ago, and I've been doing it the same way ever since because I got great results and I just kept doing it. But you know how you have, at least for the electro marker, you have your solution that you put on the touch pad that's acts as your electrolyte that the current is flowing through, and then you have a kind of a neutralizing solution that you use to kind of clean off the maker's mark and clean off the blade, because if you leave that electrolyte solution that's used for the etching part on your blade, it will start to rust pretty fucking quick, actually. I've unfortunately made that mistake. I try not to do it now.
And on stainless, it leaves a film.
Oh, it does? Okay.
Yeah, stainless, it's not
like
nice.
A white film?
Yeah, it's like a it's a white film that, and you can see on some people, you can see almost like, you can tell. So if you don't like use that neutralizing fluid, and then I go back and I hit it with the Windex, then I hit it with the acetone, I'm all over the place with it.
Yeah, and I think people use different stuff. I use that pink neutralizing solution, and I get it a little piece of paper towel cut down. It's just like basically a little 1.5 inch square, and I get that saturated. But then I squeeze most of it out, or just saturated enough. I don't want to waste a bunch of that fluid. But anyways, I want it to be fully saturated, but I don't want it to be soaking so that if I wipe the blade, there isn't a bunch of residue left behind. So I have enough on there so that the paper towel is saturated. And what I'll do is I'll mark for a 7 count because I've found that if I go too long, then sometimes the mark will like start to crawl outside of the boundaries, I guess, of what I'm wanting to etch. And so I do a 7 count, and then I I only have tape on one side. Usually it's the bottom side, depending on where else I'm doing it. It might be on the side or the top or whatever the fuck, wherever I need to put it. But basically that tape acts as a hinge for the maker's mark. So I can pivot it out of the way. I wipe the mark with that paper towel with the neutralizing solution on it. So to clear out any of that, like the white goop that you get from doing it on stainless, on carbon steel, it's kind of like a yellowish kind of goop. But anyways, you wipe that off, you wipe off the mark, and then you go back in for another 7 count. And I do that like fucking 8 to 10 times.
Wow.
But that gets me down to my mark, to the depth that I want. Because I'm thinking about like the long-term use of this knife. If I only do a few rounds, the mark will be there. But over the lifetime of the knife, if the blade is either refinished or re-hand sanded or re-ground or any of that shit, then that mark's probably going to go away. Hmm. And so I'm trying to think about, you know, down the line, especially if it has to be re-ground or re-hand sanded, is that mark something that somebody else can, it'll stay there so somebody else can refinish the blade? Or is it something that's going to have to get re-etched? I think with the advent of lasers, you can get a mark, any fucking mark, marked on a blade with lasers. But sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, so when you get your final depth, then you kind of get ready to etch?
Yeah. So I get my final depth. And I use, what is it? I use a rubberized abrasive. I've been using these rubberized abrasives for a long time. I really love them. I think you can find, I've actually found that the super eraser that you can buy at sharpening supply stores, sometimes even in like restaurant or kitchen supply stores, they're usually used for either cleaning off a blade, or they're sometimes also marketed as a way to clean out any abrasive that's on like a ceramic honing rod or something like that. But anyways, because it's abrasive mixed in with rubber, it does act like an eraser in a way. But that's a mild enough of abrasive, at least for my blade finish, that I can get in there, clean it up, and then from there, I can actually go into my etching process. And then I go through my etching process, everything looks great. But I do the etching marking my maker's mark before I even get into the acid. Now, for some reason, there's a hot tip for anybody, because I've done this before. For some reason, you have to remark the blade. Sometimes it's hard to get things lined up exactly the same. And like you said, my maker's mark is like 1.5 inches wide. At the widest point, it's about 3/8. And I have a very fine kind of like double M's insignia in the middle. And everything has to fucking line up right. Otherwise, it's going to be like I'll have a weird shadow or double etch or something like that. If you have a headlamp or even just a pen light or something like that, using that to illuminate the maker's mark over the stencil over the previous maker mark will help you to be able to line it up fucking perfectly every time. If you don't, you can try to get away with just the ambient light in your shop, but it's still really hard to see. But that extra light makes such a big difference. And like I've Don Nguyen was probably one of the first people I helped with this. And he had to do that. Like, for whatever reason, he had to get back in his blade and hand sand it, but he only pulled the maker's mark on his blade about like a half out. So he's like, fuck, what do I do? I don't want to hand sand more to pull the rest of it out or get back on the grinder. I just want to remark it, but how do I get it to line up? And so using a light of some sort, probably even honestly, that light of your phone will help, or you know, the flashlight, whatever function on your phone, will help you to get enough extra light so you can line that maker's mark up perfect. That's it.
So I think the thing is with Devil's Hollow, and the funny thing is like I've stopped doing my maker's mark deep.
Sure.
I do mark, not etch, and a lot of it's because it just don't really, it doesn't really matter to me. Like it actually, for me to do the etch and then the mark, there's a lot more room for error. There's, sure, you know, if something slips or maybe you're you know, some the tape gets liquid on it, and then it does a smear or something.
Yeah,
I've had to etch, I've had to scratch, I've had to hand sand out those marks, and I'm just I'm not doing that shit anymore.
Yeah, it's a drag.
So, and then it's like the juice just isn't worth the squeeze with some of them, and they don't look. I mean, I don't really see the, you know. So I use Mark. Now the problem is with just the Mark of the your electro etch, it doesn't come out on Damascus. It looks like somebody just drew something on there.
Yeah, it's
it just doesn't work
because it's very superficial, right?
Very superficial.
Yeah.
And the hard part is I love your idea of your of the fact that you do it deep first because you're not fighting the depth. If you've etched it already,
yeah.
Then you try to do electro etch with a stencil. You're going to be fighting the different layers of however deep you've etched the knife already. So
right. It basically creates like channels where the the fluid could flow around to, and it can fuck up your etch. So I try to do it with the surface basically as flat from a hand sanded finish as possible. Yeah. And I actually do the opposite. I only do the etch. I don't fuck around with the mark at all because I'm going through the acid etching process for the Damascus. Right. That mark does not stay.
Yeah.
Or so the darkening, I guess. The darkening aspect.
A lot of it, I just don't even fuck with it. I don't even fuck with it sometimes. I'm just like,
lasers.
You know what?
I want to do laser someday.
You know, I want to do laser too, but the problem is I just don't have a clean enough space for it. You know, my shop is just not fucking clean enough, and I just don't have the wherewithal. And the funny
thing
is,
back in the color lab.
I can't do that. I got too much stuff in there. I got too much good stuff in there. If I got rid of the Cliff's goddamn lathe, maybe I could move some shit around.
Yeah,
never mind.
There you go.
But honestly, I know that every time, and I deal with, and people ask us, and we might as well give it out. People ask us who we get our stencils from. Go to IMG. What's her face? Bruno. What's her first
Patricia
name?
Bruno.
Patricia Bruno. She's number she's one. Best. She's awesome.
Yeah.
Number two, she is fast as hell. And I know for a fact that we've been buying so many stencils lately for all the collaborations we've been doing. I know that if I had just gotten a laser a couple years ago, it would have already paid for itself. But we're going to get there when we get there, and it all works out in the end. But yeah, laser would be pretty slick.
Yeah, if you Google IMG, the three letters, space electro mark, it's the first thing that comes up.
Yeah, she's great. Patricia's great, and they're very easy to work with, and they are very quick.
Yeah.
But I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you just email her the thing.
Yeah.
And she can size it for you. She can, you know, help you if you don't have the right vector file, or I don't know, she can, you know, they'll do all that shit for you.
I sent her a hand drawn thing, and she did it.
Yeah, I don't know. She's, I mean, we just send shit to Patricia all the time. She's great.
Yeah.
And IMG is where to go. If you're in the United States, now if you're in, you know, if you're in Australia, I don't know what you should do. You got to probably ask Corin over at Gamaco, see what he says. Or ask Ian Ronald from Gamaco will tell you what to do.
Okay.
But with that said, before we get any further, we got to talk about, if you want to talk about something good, you talk about a Broadbeck. Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of 2x72 grinder. This is a grinder for knife makers and metal workers and blacksmiths and bladesmiths. You're removing material. This is the machine for you. They have a special deal going on where if you put in the promo code KnifeTalk10, you're going to get 10% off everything. And I would highly suggest taking a look at their hammers. Their new power hammers look really great. We saw them at Maker Camp. They look totally awesome. And
I used it.
Yeah, you. And what'd you think?
It was great. I forged out a great little knife, or not little. It was a large integral chef's knife.
There you go.
Yeah.
Except no substitutes. Go Broadbeck Ironworks makes great stuff in the United States, and I am 100% with them. We're both with them, and we appreciate all of them. Do you want to answer? Do the next question, or you want to do some? I like this next question from our man Bingo,
our Gold Star listener,
newly minted Gold Star listener Brigham Kendall.
Yeah, this
he
next
says,
one. Yeah, go ahead.
Whatever you want. You want me to do it?
I'll read it, I think.
Okay.
I hate New Year's resolutions. I agree with you. But I don't mind achieving goals. Do you guys have any goals you're wanting to accomplish in 2025?
I think this is a nice question from our man Bingo. Gold Star listener, newly minted, GSL. Yeah. We have two GSLs so far.
Okay.
Two GSLs. Never forget... Paul Jansen, GSL. Bingo Kendall, GSL.
So, yeah.
You want to be GSL, you got to send us in your questions to Knife Talk
good
Podcast
questions.
On Instagram.
Good suggestion.
You consistently be a good listener, and then you get the GSL in front. And I might add, I got a message from Paul Jansen, GSL, who said he wrote something on some Broadbeck post, and then they wrote, thanks, Paul, you know, and then acknowledged his GSL. His GSL position.
His GSL status.
Acknowledged. The Broadbeck guys acknowledged Paul Jansen's GSL status. So membership has its privileges.
Goals. What do you got? You got any goals?
Well, I wasn't going to talk about it, but I am going to talk about it because here we are. So I think last year I mentioned the fact that I'd done the New York City Marathon in 2013.
Okay.
And it was hard. And part of the reason it was hard is because I really wasn't on – I didn't start at a very good fitness base to start training. And I was – I ran a little bit, but I ran, but I wasn't really like – I just didn't – it was a good run. I'm glad I did it. And I was a member of the Michael J. Fox Foundation team. And a friend of mine, Brooke Gomez, had got me on it. Now, Brooke Gomez had died last year, and I probably talked about it. She died, and it was a very public and, you know, very tragic way. And I made the decision to see, I wanted to do it again. So I applied back to the Michael J. Fox Foundation to be another athlete for their team. So I'm waiting to hear back. And if it's really hard to get the New York City Marathon. There's just like, there's hundreds of thousands of people applying. Getting the lottery is like, forget it. And if you join a team that raises money, you have a automatic entry. And because I was a member of the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's team, and you know, fucking 11 years ago, I'm pulling on the heartstrings of Michael J. Fox Foundation to get me back on. Oh. I'm waiting to hear back. And my goal is to get into the New York City Marathon, which I feel good. I feel better than 50-50 on. And my goal is to run a more comfortable marathon than last one. But I want to be my pace, and I want to be more comfortable. I want to train better so I can enjoy it more.
Sure. Are you one of those guys that like pisses and shits himself while he's running?
No.
Okay.
No. No, sir. No. I don't know who does that, frankly.
You've never heard of people doing that?
I know, but that's like the heavy duty guys. That's like, I mean, literally.
Legitimately.
But that's literally. When I trained for the New York City Marathon, number one is it's an exorbitant amount of time spent running. Like, you have a specific schedule that I stuck to that builds you up. You do three short runs, and then in the weekend you do a long run, and then by the time you're close to being at the marathon, you're doing like 17 miles, 20 miles, 21 miles, 22 was the maximum. And I never one time shat myself running. I think I did in the marathon, I did see a porta potty and I did take a leak, but I did not. I also don't eat the way these guys eat. Like I can't eat the morning I'm going to run. So I have to eat the night before. So I can't, the morning of the race, I don't eat. So I don't have a whole lot going in the tank. I'm hoping to drop a couple deuces before I go on the run. Usually got to run at least one deuce in the morning before you do the run. But I have not, I've yet to evacuate mid-run.
Okay, so that was going to be one of my questions.
Go ahead.
Not necessarily like the preparation you do in regards to the actual running training.
Yeah.
But like, how are you managing your bathroom situation or nipple chafage the gooch chafage?
Easy.
Or any?
Yeah, I have answers for all of this.
Let's hear.
I have answers for all this.
Just KY jelly everywhere.
KY jelly. Are you crazy? This isn't the Christopher Street running team. I mean, this is not KY jelly. That's a deep cut that no one's going to get. That's fine. So, for one. You know, if you're running for 4 hours, you might have to take a whiz. For generally speaking, I pee enough beforehand that I don't have to go to the bathroom. And I think when you, I don't know, this might be bro science, but when you're running and you're sweating a lot, I don't think you need to take a leak as much. When I'm going on longer runs, I carry water with me, which I hate. I hate carrying anything, but I do carry water with me. I had a waistband that had a little water in it, and then like some of those little you got to do those little carbohydrate goos. Those running goos are fucking, I mean, those things are incredibly helpful. Especially if you're like hitting past 17 miles, you need a little bit of something. Mm-hmm. Nipple chafing is a thing. Nipple chasing is a thing. You can do Band-Aids. I don't do Band-Aids. I do have chafe cream for the nips. I haven't really used them very often. I don't remember really making it part of the routine.
Okay.
And in regard to the gooch, my legs don't touch when I'm running. So there's not a lot of
gap. Look at you, Mr. Gap.
There's not a lot of leg chafing. And then the way that I have shorts that have like a liner it's not like a bathing suit. So it kind of goes down your leg a little bit. So there's not real chafing in the gooch department.
It's like bicycle short liner on the inside of running pants, shorts.
Yeah, it's kind of unnoticeable, but there's you're not getting a wedgie. You're not getting a wedgie.
Sure.
That's. But it's a good question because I do have a favorite pair of running shorts that I can't find anymore. And I'm really, that's always the biggest problem when you find something that you really like and you can't find it again. I have a funny story, but this is a funny story that happened recently. I did get a pair of new running shoes that I really, really liked. And I was walking the dog, and one of my dogs getting a little older. He took a shit, and then I was grabbing the bag to pick up the shit, and then he stepped in the shit, then he stepped on the shoe, the new running shoe. So I said, Hillary, so there was a fucking poo foot stain on my new running shoe, not that new, a couple months old. I said, Hillary, what can we do about this? And she goes, throw them out because they're not coming into this house. So that
really?
Does
you
happen.
You didn't try hosing them off and then washing them?
It was freezing. It was no hosing off. It was just like, let's just fucking start over. But what are the things? I'm really crossing my fingers because I'm going to be hitting everybody up because of the amount of money I promised to raise is going to be way more than I expected. And I'm going to be fucking making a lot of content around it. But I do actually have food training things that I used to do. I came up with a sandwich. I'll tell you, this is probably the best thing I ever came up with in when I was training. And when I was training for the marathon, I was like training from June all the way to Halloween. So it was like, there were days off to recover, but I mean, I was running 5 to 6 days a week. And I was like, that was fucking, it was great. Oh, it was awesome. I loved it. See, the thing about the running...
I just dry heaved a little bit.
Let me tell you why the running's good. You got it. If you don't worry about your legs, if you focus on your breathing, you can go into kind of like a kind of meditation situation. And then all of a sudden, if you keep the rhythm and you're breathing in a specific way, you do go on a little trip. I must say, but you got to go past 3 miles. Like first 3 miles, I mean, it's some bullshit. You get past 3 miles and then you're all of a sudden you get to a point where you have no feeling below your waist, and then you're just like running and you're just cruising and you just don't want to stop. So I'm all in, but I made a sandwich that would run past on the way home. I was, you know, after running 15 miles, 17 miles, you're fucking starving. So I would go to where we used to get a bacon, egg, and cheese. And I made a marathon sandwich my kid loves called the marathon sandwich. It's a Kaiser roll with, egg whites, smoked turkey, or pepper turkey, whatever. Tomato, salt and pepper, and American cheese. It's like a healthier fake BEC. And goddamn, I would get two of them and I would wolf them down so fast on the way home. It was like unbelievable. So
okay,
yeah. So my goal is I hope to get into the New York City Marathon, and I want to do it in a better way. 12 years later.
You said you get into like almost a kind of trippy state or a runner's high. Can you describe that more? What is that?
Yes.
Like?
I mean, it's not like I'm seeing visions, but you do get a degree of euphoria. And a lot of it's always the breathing. That's why all these like yoga guys, it's all about the breathing.
Yeah.
If you focus on your breathing in a very, very specific way and then do it for a long period of time, you end up in this weird meditative state.
Yeah.
And it's a flow state that is, once you can tap into it, it is very addictive. And I don't really, like I said, I don't really talk like that. I'm not a fucking woo guy. I'm not telling you what to do. I would hop into it, and it would be like, I could do this for a long time. And then that was the only reason why I could do the running. Now, the other thing about the running is, especially long distance, is you have to have, for your mind to allow you to do, you can't just run anywhere. You kind of need to know the route, because you need these little moments along the race where you or around on the track or whatever, where you know where you are, you know how far you need to go.
I got you.
Because otherwise, it's like, am I done? You know, if you don't
need,
New York City Marathon, I know the city. I know the route like the back of my hand. So, like, by the time you get to the 59th Street Bridge, you're about to go up First Avenue, you know where the fuck you are. And then you kind of have – and it helps you kind of, like, figure out your endurance but also figure out your pace. So you know when to kind of turn it on, when to turn it off, when to kind of coast, when to, like – I love long-distance running.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever heard of – I feel like breath work has become a big thing, especially with like Wim Hof. And then there's also the John Nestor's book, Breathe, which is a really fucking good read if anybody's interested, about just understanding how important the way we're breathing is and how it affects your health and your life.
Well, you know who's a big Wim Hof guy is Nick Anger.
Oh, nice.
Dude. That fucking dude sends me videos.
Oh,
he's he's breaking the ice. He's a ice bath champ. He says it's changed his life.
Number one. Number one in the knife making game in the ice bath.
I ain't doing that.
But So the psychedelics were a thing, obviously, for a long time, and then they went away. And there's a psychologist in California named Stanislav Lavgrov, and he developed a technique called holotropic breathwork. And it takes inspiration from kind of somatic breathing that comes from yogic or Hindu tradition, and as well as kind of like the breath of fire or Wim Hof style breathing. But it does get you to altered states of consciousness, and they are using it. Often, it's usually in a group setting, though you can do it in private sessions. But to go through and have that experience to try to do some kind of like therapeutic work, because it does take you to a different, not realm, but just like a different level of consciousness. That is a fucking full on medically proven thing. That is actually, it sounds like it's helped a lot of people. With a lot of shit from like PTSD and other kind of traumas and stuff like that to work through that stuff. So it's interesting to hear you say that you experienced that while you're doing the running.
I have to like qualify it by saying I'm not like, you know, in some sort of like dream world.
Yeah, no.
It's the pace of your running.
Sure.
And then you kind of like align that with the pace of your breathing, and you're breathing in a very specific way. Like, sure. I learned to breathe in a very specific way, and it's also based on your pace. But it takes a long time before you start to, like, all of a sudden, you don't feel like, you don't feel the physicality of the running.
Sure.
You're just running. And you don't feel pain, you're in this kind of weird meditative state. It does help to listen to something, like... I listen to a podcast or something and just get your mind off of it. I probably listen to Howard Stern. When I ran the New York City Marathon, that was when I listened to Joe Rogan. I would listen to his podcasts, were great for long runs because they yammer on for 3 or 4 hours and it's not a big deal. That's on a personal level, that's my goal, is to get in and then to do it right. And now my wife's nervous because my knee fell apart in the last race, and she says, I don't want you to do anything that's going to hurt you. And I promised her that if it gets to the point where I don't feel well doing it, I won't just push myself like I did last time. So
can I ask?
Then,
I wanted to ask, just I feel like I keep pushing it.
Go ahead.
About the breathing. I'm curious what you're doing. Like, I've done some breathing kind of thoughtful breathing while I was working out and running at the gym or something like that. But I have to do like 3 short breaths in as I'm stepping, basically in cadence with my steps. And that before doing kind of a longer, just it's like 3 in, 3 out, or 4 in, 4 out kind of thing. And I don't know if, like, I don't think I was paying attention to, like, the shape of my mouth while I was breathing. Or are you breathing through your nose? Are you breathing through your mouth?
I think I'm breathing two in, two out.
Two in, two out. Interesting.
Right. But it's like...
But they're short.
I mean, I'm really trying... I'm not really... I don't know.
Right. You don't want to think about it too much. It's probably with... Is it... Do you feel like it's with
it's a deeper breath. I mean, it's a deeper breath than just your regular breath. But you're also running. So you also have to kind of go past cramping. You have to go past... I mean, I did a lot of running after college, and I was a member of the Roadrunners Club, and we did a half marathon. Half marathon, if you're going to get into running, half marathon is the best fucking race. Because you're not getting that ridiculous fatigue at 24 miles. Like a 13-mile half marathon. If I could only do one run all the time, it would be 13 miles. 13 miles is like a fucking, you break
like
yourself
in the middle of the runner's high.
Well,
and then you're done.
It's the problem is for me is I don't feel good until after 2.5-3 miles.
Sure.
So like the first 3 miles suck, and I'm fine. But the best part is knowing that after 3 miles, your warm up is over. So like that's the good part. In regards to the breathing, no one taught me the breathing, but I felt like if I connected my breathing to my running, I'd kind of not feel any kind of pain, and that was really what happened. Yeah. But it hit me up, and listen, this is, you know, whatever you, any questions. My goal is in general is I am not going to be a victim of bad health later in life if I can handle it. And my wife is doing a lot of weight training. I'm starting when I get into this, I'm going to do a lot more weight training and stuff like that, because when I get older, I don't want to be in pain, and I don't want to bend down and breathe deep when I can't fucking tie my shoe. And you got to be able to lift yourself up at a certain age.
Sure.
And I refuse to just allow my body to just not age well. I don't want to be a burden later in my life. I don't want to be a burden later in my life.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like I refuse. So if I can get in on this, I'll tell you this. If I get on this and I can be on there every year, I'll do the New York City Marathon every year as long as
Damn.
I can do it. If I can't, if I get in this year, you know, I would. What happens is, and I know that we're going on and on about this, I tell you what happens. So you do the run. The biggest problem is training on asphalt is great because you think it's similar to running in the city. The problem is most of the city's concrete. So it's fucking abusive to your joints and your knees that you're not prepared for. So you get to, by the time I got to 13 miles in, I started to feel knee pain, and then I had problems. And then running over the 59th Street Bridge was like fucking running on a steel grate, which sucked for a long time. And then going up First Avenue, and then by the time you get to the Bronx, you're just kind of shot. And then by the time you go down back into the park where you're finishing off, you're going through, your brain starts to pump in. It takes all your emotions and puts them in a cocktail shaker, shakes them all around, and then fires them out. You're happy, then you're sad, then you're angry, then you're mad, then you're crying, then you're happy, and then you're laughing, and then you're mad.
Emotional roulette.
Oh, dude, it's like a fucking whirlwind after 26 miles.
Sure.
You're fucking crazy. So, yeah, I'll do it.
So you get yourself a pair of shoes like Craig's, like fucking orthopedic shit, or like, what do you do?
No, you know what the funny part is? So when you get out of it, you have to walk another mile and a half to get out of the park, which you're just like, you can barely move. You can't bend your knees. You're fucking drained.
But the lactic acid buildup has got to be pretty gnarly, right?
You're boned. You can't go down the stairs to the subway. It was me and my family in Grand Central. I could barely get down the goddamn stairs. The cool thing was the cops opened up all the subways and we didn't have to pay for the subway. That was really cool.
That's great.
And then we got in. I could barely get up the stairs from the subway into Grand Central. And then by the time I got home, I had to go to jury duty the next day.
I couldn't get
down the fucking not jury duty. I had a parking ticket I had to take care of. I could barely get down the stairs in the house. I didn't know how I was going to get to the courthouse because I couldn't bend my fucking knees. So there's a lot. It's a lot. It's abuse, really. What sure. It's fucking abuse. But New York City is the greatest city in the world. I've said enough. Unless you have any more questions.
Nah, I think I did it.
We did it. What are your? Do you have any goals?
I think most of my goals probably have to do with like my mental health more than anything.
That's good.
That's really. I mean, I do have some health goals. Just like physicality, I don't necessarily want to like start weight training or anything like that because I'm not an athlete. I've been athletic my whole life, but I want to be able to keep up with my kid, really.
Right.
You know, and you know, until he's, you know, 25, 30 years old, which will put me at about 60 at that point, 60, 65. And so, if I want to keep going that long, at least, and honestly longer, I gotta take care of myself now. And so I'm trying to take steps to, just do regular, not necessarily weight training, but just like practical application kind of training.
Consistency is always, Craig makes fun of me because I've talked about a lot of people thought when I got the Peloton during the pandemic that I'd give it up. I never gave it up. I do it 6 days a week still, and I have different goals and stuff like that. And I just, it's no questions asked.
Sure.
And now my wife just turned 51, and her doctor said she feels that she needs to get more, have more muscle mass because as she grows older, her mm-hmm. parent, her mother, her grandmother had osteoporosis, and we got to build muscle mass because, right. you know, as you get older, you got to be able to do shit. So we're it's just set in stone. And it's 30 minutes. I mean, I do a Peloton every morning. Sometimes I'll watch an old Knicks game. I got to have the good looking girls on. I can't do it with these fucking, I get the good looking girls. I get the girls, good looking girls on the Peloton, and then I'll have something else going on. Oh, dude, my wife said the same thing. She's like, I do the good looking guys. I'm like, and she looks at me and she's like, don't tell me you don't put the good looking girls on. I'm like, I didn't say anything. So
I guess another goal along with fitness is just honestly just doing a better job with general stretching as well, because the work that we're doing at standing at a grinder, forging, you know, it does put awkward strains on our body, especially if you work more on your kind of your dominant side. So if you're right, I'm right-handed, so if I do most of my, I don't forge with my left hand, right? So I'm you're doing these asymmetric work, and so you got to take care of your body. Yeah. And I know what I'm supposed to do. I just don't do it, and I pay for it. Lately I've actually had some really bad neck and back pain. It's been somewhat debilitating, which also has not been helping with my mental state, and so has been frustrating. But it's amazing. Like, you do a little bit of stretching, and it's you're not a whole new person, but it makes such a difference. And I'm like, holy fuck. And it only takes a couple minutes. That's the worst part. It's so dumb. It just takes
a couple minutes. The craziest thing is I think that the biggest problem is people think that it's instantaneous.
Oh, yeah.
It's just got to be part of your thing. So, I mean, my weight change has been a very, when I first started in, I lost a ton of weight, and then I kind of gained it back in muscle. Like, I'm definitely like a little bit, I lost a shit ton of fat, and then I kind of like gain more weight, but not like, I don't have like a beer gut. It's still, when you look down, my metric is what sticks out the furthest. You should see toes, then dick, then stomach. So if it's toes, dick, stomach, you're in good shape. That's the litmus test. So toes, dick, stomach, you're in good. And then, but it took a long time. It takes a long time. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
And, I tell you what though, losing a lot of weight, really, I have not had back pain in years,
yeah,
and
sure.
A lot of it has to do with, but let's just talk about shoes. You have a pair of, would you have a work boots that you like or shoes that you like?
I still have my Brunt, and I really like using those. But I feel like I can only unfortunately wear them for limited periods of time, and they actually start to hurt my feet Yeah, more than anything, I'm hurting my feet. And I think I got like the widest pair that I can. And I just have Polynesian feet. And it took me a while to realize this, but I come from Polynesian heritage. half Samoan on my dad's side, and I could never understand like these big old mitts and these wide ass feet and what the deal was. And I realized they're fucking paddles. The Polynesians are people that, you know, evolved, like, not necessarily evolved, but just like live for hundreds of years on islands and still do. And being in the water and being able to get yourself around in the water or out of the fucking water if a shark's after you or something like that is important. And that's why I got these big old things. But maybe, it does make it tricky.
You ever wear Birkenstocks?
No, I've never worn
Birkenstocks. Are wide.
Are they?
Birkenstocks are
looking
are
at Keens, too.
Birkenstocks, I tell you what, I know a lot of great blacksmiths who wear Birkenstocks. They're not the best looking of a shoe.
I must say,
I have Birkenstocks. I have Birkenstocks. They're not the. I mean, let's be clear to our listeners. They're not the best looking shoe, but they're comfortable as fuck.
Sure.
But they're really. When I say they're not the best looking shoe, they really aren't the best looking shoe. They're not even close to the best looking shoe.
Sure.
They don't even. They're not even at the quarter of the best. They're not. They're on the lower end of the scale of worst looking shoe, but they are fucking great for wide feet. So sure. I would think you should suggest that. You can get them closed-toed, too. So the clogs. But I tell you what, I finally found a pair. My wife got me a pair of Doc Martens a while ago, and I loved them, except for the fact that I wore through the sole too quickly.
I got you.
And I was just like, I can't keep buying shoes every 6 months because the soles wear out. I got a pair of Danner. I talked to Ben Snoer and I talked to Riley's Kirkpatrick.
Sure.
And they're big. They like whites. They're big in the whites.
The white sole.
No. Whites is a company that makes handcrafted boots. Okay. And they swear by whites. And I heard about them, but I just can't. It's just higher up than that I want to pay.
Was it like $700 for a pair?
Right. But I mean, they're made in America. They last forever, whatever.
Yeah.
I got a pair of Danner mock toe boots, like electrician's boots with the white sole.
Sure.
Fucking love them.
They're great boots. I got a pair of those once and I wore them I gave them a decent amount of time and they'd never stretched out that my feet were just too wide for them. I was fucked. So I got rid of them and I ended up getting just like Georgia boot or something stupid.
Yeah, no, these mock toe from Danner are really good on my back. And then I also have, in front of all my grinders and where I'm standing, we have those restaurant mats.
Oh, yeah.
And that's been huge, too, because you're just standing up straight on a fucking piece of concrete is no good.
For sure. Yeah, they make a difference.
And with that said, I did get a message from Carly. Over Damasteel. So we're gonna end with the old Damasteel.
Okay.
So last week we were talking about Damasteel and we were talking about the idea of somebody getting a fake tooth out of Damasteel. And that maybe we said that Pear should get some Damasteel grills. Now if you want to know what Damasteel is, Damasteel is the best pattern welded stainless on the market. You go to damasteel.se and then you check out what they got. And if you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you get 10% off everything. Go see what it's all about. You go to damasteel AB on Instagram. So we got a message from Carly, and here's what Carly said.
Okay.
She said, number one, a Damasteel grill for Pear. Pear is the chairman of the board, I guess. He's the big mocker over there at Damasteel. So Damasteel grill for Pear is in the works. They're going to make a pair.
Nice.
It's going to be unbelievable. Tell Craig there's also a Canadian version of a pottery throwdown produced by Seth Rogen, which is also fabulous. Do you know about this?
I don't know.
Seth Rogen did a Canadian version of pottery throwdown.
I didn't know that.
And then she said the last thing is she hopes my daughter is safe and out of harm's way from the fire.
Oh, thank you so much.
So definitely we're going to talk more to Carly at some point, and she is going to get a Damasteel. Damasteel teeth are being made, ladies and germs. Mm-hmm. And if you, once again, you go to damasteel.se, put in promo code KNIFETALK10, you get 10% off. And you too can start carving out your own Damasteel grills or make beautiful knives or make axes or make whatever you want with them. Damasteel.se, and that's it.
Nice.
I think we did it. Guys, we can do a little after show. You want to do a little after show?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Guys, listen to me. You've been great, but you can be greater You could be a Gold Star listener, but you got to go to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. You send us your messages and steer the ship. You have to think of it as steering the ship. If there's a question you want answered, we answered a lot of questions today. Put them in. Send them your DMs. And this is your chance to steer the ship. Otherwise, we're going to do dick jokes. Plain and simple. It's going to be dick jokes.
We're going to talk about running and people shitting their pants.
We're going to talk shitting pants. Nipples. We're going to talk about social media because some people still want to talk about social media. But it's your opportunity to steer the ship. So go ahead. Night Talk Podcast on Instagram. And we will see you next week. What are you watching? Anything good?
I started watching the new, or actually we finished it, the second season of Squid Games.
Oh, God. Is it good?
Yeah. Such no, it's good.
It's just a depressing show.
It is depressing, and it's brutal. It's gory. Although I feel like this season was not as bad as their first season. Mm. And then I think I started watching the Vikings series.
Right.
That's been going all right. I'm in the fifth season, and it's like the main guy that was like the first four seasons died now. And sorry, spoilers. This was from 2015. So
oh, shit.
Get over it.
I don't have to watch it now. That's perfect.
And now it's focused on his sons, but it's kind of like, I don't know. It's a lot of this kind of like infighting stuff that's not as, and the characters aren't as interesting either. And so I'm just having kind of a hard time with it and whether or not I'm going to finish it. But there's only six seasons, so I'm like, fuck, I got to just finish this thing.
It's so much time out of your life, though. Jesus Christ. Yeah. I tried with The Penguin, man, and I swear to God, I'm waiting for everybody to talk. I'm waiting for something good to happen. I'm just like, all right. I gave it up. The last I watched was like, all right, when are you getting better? When are you getting better?
Sure.
But I'm actually taking my daughter, my high school friend is taking his daughter, and I'm taking my daughter. We're going to go see the Knicks on it. When this comes out on Monday, we're going to go see the Knicks, and I get to deal with congestion pricing. I swear to God.
Oh.
New York City, I love New York. New York is my third parent. New York City saved my life. I love New York City, but they fucking put in a congestion pricing where you have to pay $9 when you go in. Below 60th Street, and is such a fucking mistake.
Whoa, for real?
It's such a fucking mistake, and it's like they have raised all the tolls. It's very expensive to get in the city in general. Take the train, it's expensive, to the point where, depending on how many people you are, it's almost cheaper to drive in, but now there's congestion pricing, and it's a fucking mess, and I'm actually kind of down on my favorite place on the planet. I'm very down on New York right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, everyone is too, because this congestion pricing is just like, what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
You're going to gouge us again? I mean, it's like fucking $9 every time we go in and out of the city. Fuck out of here.
Interesting.
Oh, it's terrible. And it's people who work in New York aren't just, you know, rich and famous people. There are like people making it happen. I mean, when Hillary and I lived on 14th Street, we were struggling to kind of cough it up and live this life.
Sure.
And just to shove another $10 or fuck, if you're going to go back and forth, $18 on someone, it's like too much, man.
For sure.
Too much.
Last episode, you had potentially had some sort of news that you're waiting
New
to hear
York
back.
City Marathon.
Oh, that. That's
yeah,
what,
so
okay.
I'm waiting to hear back from the.
I see.
I didn't really want to talk about it because it felt like, you know, if it doesn't happen, I'm going to be bummed out. But
sure.
And I thought maybe don't put it out in the universe because, you know, it's a can of horror and you don't want to do that. And then I was just like, you know, the big news was going to be if I got in, and I'm hoping to hear they're supposed to tell you soon because the application for the New York City Marathon is February to March. You have a short window to get the. So you get. Once you get confirmation from the team that you're going to be running on,
okay,
then you apply for the marathon, and then you say that I'm running for this team, and then you get automatic. There's no like, you automatically get accepted. So if the Michael J. Fox Foundation says yeah, well come on back, then when I apply for the New York City Marathon, it's instantaneous. So it's like a workaround.
I gotcha.
Yeah, so that's it. I mean,
that was the news.
We got some other media things coming on that we're working on, but I mean, it's like it's too early in the game to talk about.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
But that's it. I got nothing else to say. Listen, guys. Guys, listen. Listen to me. It's good talking to you. It's always good to talk to my little brother, Mareko Mamasi, my guy. Craig will be back next week. So go to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram and do me a favor. Send in a question and tell your friends. When you see, when you put up the thing for on Instagram, share it to your stories. Tell your friends. We're here for you. Okay? Mareko, I hope you have a great week.
We'll
see you next week.
Have fun with the kid.
All right, my brother. I'll talk to you later. All right, guys. See you next week. Take it away, Craig.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.